It really starts with the actual making of the movie, you know, when I start working with my operator. We imagine every sequence of the movie and we really discuss about every shot, you know. And at the end, before the start of the shooting, we have a kind of a Bible, extremely precise, you know. And we try to find the ADN of the movie, you know. And on this movie, the ADN is the traveling, the movement. The idea that every camera movement is going to irrigate the movie as the blood is irrigating the body, in a way.
Director Cattell Quillavere discussing her beautiful new film, Heal the Living, and its musical score by the legendary Alexander Desplat. We'll find out how the young filmmaker approached the giant of the industry with a job offer today on The Cinema Show. Also ahead.
These filmmakers, I think, were actually attuned to something that a lot of us here in New York were not attuned to over the last year, which was, I think, the mood of the country itself.
It wasn't just an appearance by Hillary Clinton that gave this year's Tribeca Film Festival a distinctly political feel. We'll cross to the offices of New Republic magazine for a look at the list of documentaries making waves. And...
wasn't that scene supposed to be in the movie?
I didn't think so. It wasn't in the script, but then so many things aren't, you know?
Well, how'd they take a movie of...
I was a teenager.
From being held captive in pre-war Vienna to a career on the Hollywood screen and a side project as a genius inventor, we'll explore the truly incredible story of Hedy Lamarr. That's all to come on The Cinema Show right here on Monocle 24.
I first became really focused on the horrific slaughter of elephants when I was Secretary of State, because it became clearer to everyone that this was not just a terrible crisis when it came to the elephant population. It was a trade, a trafficking that was funding a lot of bad folks, a lot of bad actors. It was funding militias, it was funding the Lord's Resistance Army.
That's Hillary Clinton making a surprise appearance at the screening of Catherine Bigelow's short virtual reality documentary, The Protectors, A Walk in the Ranger's Shoes. The VR project recalls a day in the life of a ranger on patrol in the Garumba National Park in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Facing constant danger, these rangers are often the only marker of defense for elephants in a race for survival against the threat of poachers and extinction. But as Mrs. Clinton explained during the panel discussion, this isn't only about animal welfare and the ivory trade. The lucrative industry feeds its profits to some very dark activities.
It's really important for everybody here to know that there is something you can do. There's a specific program that provides support for the rangers themselves. You can go to outfitaranger.org. which is part of African Parks, and literally you can contribute to buy a new vest, decent shoes, create at least a better chance for those rangers to be able to do their jobs and to not only protect the wildlife, but protect themselves.
This is The Cinema Show on Monocle 24. I'm Ben Rylan. Politics and cinema are never too far from each other, but after last year's political upheaval, 2017's festival season is sure to be filled with voices reflecting on and attempting to make sense of our strange new world. But while it might feel like an eternity, Donald Trump is only celebrating his 100th day in office this weekend. Judging from the lineup at New York's Tribeca Film Festival, which wraps this weekend, filmmakers have been quick to respond to the world's collective state of uncertainty. Alex Shepard is news editor at New Republic magazine in New York.
It's a little surprising given that no one, even Donald Trump, expected that he was going to win on November 8th, but a lot of the documentaries in Tribeca seem to be focused on Donald Trump, at least on a subtextual level, but two really stand out. One is The Reagan Show, which is done in the style where they only use archival footage of Ronald Reagan. And it's sort of similar to a movie that came out a couple of years ago called R. Nixon that also used archival footage of Richard Nixon. But this movie is entirely focused on the artifice of Ronald Reagan's presidency, how he sort of staged it for the cameras. And in a lot of ways, it's very reminiscent of the first 100 days of Trump's presidency. There have been all these sort of, you know, loud executive orders and bombastic tweets, but the results so far are a little shaky. Another one is Get Me Roger Stone, which is one of the best documentaries at the festival, I think. It sort of follows Roger Stone, who is a longtime political operator, first came up in the Nixon campaign, and is sort of a master of the dark arts of politics. But like Trump, it's never entirely clear how effective Stone actually is. He's very good at getting publicity for himself. He's very good at inserting himself into the conversation. He's very good at degrading political discussion. But he is maybe not quite the sort of extraordinarily impressive figure that he claims, although he is certainly a Zelig figure of contemporary American politics.
And why do you think that filmmakers have really taken up the mantle of jumping into this political documentary arena, particularly at Tribeca? Because, I mean, obviously, politics and cinema have never been too far apart, especially when it comes to documentaries. And we've been seeing political films seep into the programming at festivals around the globe as well. But do you think there's something specific about Tribeca being a film festival very much taking place in New York? It's very much known as a film festival for New York. Has that got something to do with political documentaries wanting to really make their presence known at this particular festival?
I think that the opposite might actually be true. I mean, watching some of these movies, there are others like No Man's Land, which is a documentary about this sort of militia that took over a wildlife refuge in Oregon, movie Gray State, which is about this sort of paranoid libertarian fantasy movie that was created by a sort of alt-right figure. These filmmakers, I think, were actually attuned to something that a lot of us here in New York were not attuned to over the last year, which was, I think, the mood of the country itself, which is sort of on edge, paranoid. Things are not going as well in a lot of the non sort of urban cultural elite settings. And while a movie like Get Me Roger Stone is very focused on this sort of dandy, it also is fixated on this kind of drive that Roger Stone has to kind of get back at coastal elites, almost an inarticulate drive. But I think that, you know, a lot of the movies at the festival are really attuned to the mood of the country, which people didn't pick up on. Another one that's been getting a lot of attention is this movie Tilt, which is a feature that was started in, I think, the fall of 2015, but it's about an unemployed documentary filmmaker who is essentially driven mad by his obsession with Donald Trump. And it's essentially a feature film about this moment right now when all we can think about is Donald Trump and this, you know, young man is driven insane by it.
Perhaps something we can all something we can all relate to, at least at the moment, being driven mad by it all. I mean, does that really sum up, do you think, the overall Trump effect on Tribeca? His presence seems to be hanging over the festival very much as far as the outward publicity would go. We saw that video pop up recently of Hillary Clinton appearing at a Q&A about Catherine Bigelow's Elephant documentary, that VR piece that she'd worked on. And immediately, Hillary Clinton became that story. It wasn't about the film, although, of course, the film itself, of course, certainly warranting a lot of attention too. But really, the fact that Hillary Clinton had really attended this film really became something of a story unto itself, which really does suggest that people are viewing everything happening at film festivals at the moment, at first, through some sort of political lens.
Partly it's just a media fixation of, you know, what is the Donald Trump angle on this story. But on the other hand, I think that immediately after the election of Barack Obama, I think there was a much more sort of hopeful mood in a lot of the art that was created, which was about the kind of coming quasi-utopian multicultural future of the country. And, you know, even though he was elected in an economic downturn, and with the rise of the Tea Party 2 years later and then Occupy Wall Street in 2011, I think it just is sort of taken art a little while to catch up. And I think what we've seen at the festival is this sort of mood of the country really start to seep into the kind of movies that are being produced. And that's not to say that there isn't still your sort of standard Little Miss Sunshine-y flair to the festival, but I've been really surprised by how much the films themselves have really honed in on the sort of dark heart of America at the moment.
It's no secret that when we look back at maybe some more difficult times in America's political history, for instance, the Nixon age, if you look at films that were made during that time, many of the films do seem to be presenting themselves as a sort of antidote to whatever was happening politically at the time. And in retrospect, we can look at that period in cinema and sometimes view that as a bit of a golden age of creativity and political filmmaking. What are your thoughts on how films are going at the moment? We're very early in Trump's presidency, of course, but do you have hope that maybe looking at this 10, 20, 30 years from now, we'll look back and think, well, these were the films that were really responding to that in a constructive way, in a way that really helped people make sense of what was happening?
I guess I have a lot of faith in documentary filmmaking at the moment, I think partly because I think there's a real renaissance happening right now. I think this is absolutely a golden age in that art form. In feature films, I'm a little less optimistic. I think one of the reasons that the art in the early 1970s in particular was so great was that the studio system had kind of exploded. They had no idea how to react to all of these changes, and they kind of let the barbarians sort of ransacked Hollywood for a few years. Right now, I think that is not going to happen there. But I do think that some enterprising studio executive right now is looking for the next hell or high water type movie that will really speak to a lot of the anger that is driving American politics right now.
That's Alex Shepard at New Republic magazine. One of the other films capturing attention at Tribeca is a new documentary about the actress Hedy Lamarr. But this is far from another retread of Hollywood's golden age. Hedy Lamarr was also a celebrated inventor, and her life story is perhaps the most fascinating of any legend of the motion picture industry. Alexandra Dean's new documentary, Bombshell, brings to life the little-known story behind one of Hedy's inventions that ultimately aided the creation of Wi-Fi and Bluetooth. But we'll start our look at Hedy's life a little earlier, in pre-war Europe, when she found herself held prisoner by a confidant of Mussolini. If Hedwig Eva Maria Kiesler had been born today, she might not have bothered with a career on the stage and screen at all. Possessing a fierce intelligence quite beyond many of her peers, it's interesting to consider the direction her life might have taken had she been empowered to pursue something other than fulfilling the exotic ideal of the early 1930s screen siren. Towards the end of the 1920s, young Hedy was spotted by a producer, Max Reinhardt, and lured to the bright lights of Berlin. After working on her craft and performing on the stage, the young hopeful returned to Vienna, where she set her sights on a career in the movies. She even managed a meeting with MGM chief Louis B. Mayer, who generously shared his thoughts on the explicit differences between Europe's film industry and the ballooning output back in Hollywood. As he bluntly put it, "Naked smut may fly over here, but don't expect to make a career in Hollywood." In 1932, Hedwig found what could have been her first big break, though it didn't exactly work out that way, at least not immediately. Ecstasy tells the story of a young woman trapped in a passionless marriage to an older, wealthy man. In the grip of frustration, she chances upon another, much younger man during a spell of nude swimming. While Ecstasy was not the first film to show actual nudity, many believe it to be the earliest depiction of sex in a non-pornographic film. During production of the famed orgasm scene, Hedy apparently had trouble conjuring what was considered an appropriate facial reaction. The effect was achieved by repeatedly jabbing her naked backside with a safety pin while the camera focused on her face. Instead of capitalizing on the scandal, as Marilyn Monroe would do decades later in the wake of that Playboy spread, Hedy chose a different path. She married a wealthy ammunition businessman named Friedrich Mandel.
"I am very glad to be here. to express my friendly feelings towards the American nation. Friendship with which Italy looks at the millions of citizens.
His contact book included just about every power broker in Vienna. But there were also some dark names in there, such as the Italian dictator Benito Mussolini. And despite being Jewish, Mandel was apparently an esteemed enough citizen to warrant the title of honorary Aryan, bestowed by Adolf Hitler. Initially, the marriage might have seemed fairly convenient for young, naive Hetty. She was virtually a kept woman by a wealthy, powerful man who at least appeared to have his wife's best interests at heart. When an American release of Ecstasy was looming, Mandel put his considerable resources to work, purchasing every copy of the print that he could find and having them burned. Soon, however, things took a dark turn. Hetty's basic freedoms were slowly restricted. She was only allowed out of the house at certain times or for certain purposes, and her personal finances were replaced by a small allowance controlled by her husband. Then her telephone calls were monitored. When Mandel travelled, their staff were instructed not to let Hetty leave the house. She became a prisoner in her own home. And yet, when Mandel's associates visited in the evenings, it was expected that Hetty would play the role of hostess. Dinner gatherings would often involve the likes of Benito Mussolini and others from his circle. During one dinner, Hetty overheard a British colonel expressing disapproval of the Nazi movement. Sensing an opportunity, Hetty waited patiently for Mandel to leave the room before she quickly whispered in the ear of the colonel, begging him to help her leave Vienna. The colonel agreed, but only if she could find a way to contact him after he'd left their home. That evening, after their guests had departed, Mandel casually approached Hetty with the suggestion of listening to some music. But when he dropped the needle on the record, it wasn't music that she heard. It was her own voice. Mandel had been recording every moment of Hetty's brief conversation with the colonel. With her every move already being monitored, Hetty's short leash became even shorter. Rumours of problems in their marital home were spreading all over Vienna, but few could have known the extreme nature of Hetty's dilemma. Now forced to keep all her jewellery in a safe that only her husband could access, she started thinking one step ahead of Mandel. Each night, before handing over her jewels, she'd keep one or two pieces and post them to a friend in Paris, who would sell the pieces and keep the cash for her. When she'd built herself enough of a nest egg, it was time to hatch her ultimate escape plan. She waited until Mandel was away on a trip. Of course, the house staff knew never to let her leave the property, so Hetty picked one of her maids, Laura, who she had initially hired for her resemblance to herself. Hetty slipped 3 sleeping pills into Laura's coffee and, after stealing her uniform, snuck out of the house through the maid's exit and stepped on board the first Trans-Europe Express bound for Paris. By the time she arrived in the French capital, Mandel had already been informed of her escape plot and he was on her trail. When a maid told Hetty that her husband was on his way to Paris, she immediately jumped on board another train, this time to Calais, before boarding a boat to London. MGM's boss Louis B. Mayer just happened to be in town, so Hetty made contact with a friend who worked as a talent agent and asked if he could put her in touch with the all-powerful king of Hollywood's most prestigious studio. Mayer was getting ready to board an ocean liner back to the United States, but he remembered Hetty from their first meeting and agreed to see her. As she might have expected, Mayer's attitude towards scandalous nudity had not wavered. But Hetty insisted that she'd been young, naive, and coerced into performing those now internationally notorious scenes. Perhaps feeling sorry for her, Mayer offered a standard contract at MGM, the kind dangled in front of many young hopefuls who may or may not ever get a real chance at making an impression. After initially refusing, Hetty changed her mind at the last minute and made a mad dash for the cruise liner. She spent the voyage disguised as the governess of a young, celebrated violin player who was also on board. It was a ruse performed to such convincing effect that, by the time the ship docked in New York, Louis B. Mayer had increased his offer of a studio contract, and Hedy Lamarr was on her way to becoming MGM's next big star. The extraordinary story of how Hedy Lamarr made ecstasy, escaped from her abusive husband, became a Hollywood legend, and invented a radio guidance system that aided the creation of Wi-Fi is told with exceptional detail by Karina Longworth in her podcast, You Must Remember This. Alexandra Dean's new documentary, Bombshell, The Hedy Lamarr Story, premiered at the Tribeca Film Festival. Keep an eye out for distribution details. Still to come, we'll speak to the director, Catel Quillavier, about her new film, Heal the Living, and its score by composer extraordinaire, Alexandre Desplat. This is The Cinema Show. Stay tuned. When The Silence of the Lambs took the Oscar for Best Picture in 1992, it might have struck many as a curious choice. The previous year's winner had been an epic Western drama, Dances with Wolves. The year before that saw the big award go to the heartwarming drama, Driving Miss Daisy. Giving the top honour to a horror thriller that had many screaming in the seats and running for the exits was always going to be a controversial choice. But as critic Roger Ebert wrote, the popularity of Jonathan Demme's movie is likely to last as long as there is a market for being scared. Like Nosferatu, Psycho, and Halloween, it illustrates that the best thrillers don't age. Fear is a universal emotion and a timeless one. The film's director, Jonathan Demme, passed away this week at the age of 73. The star of The Silence of the Lambs, Jodie Foster, said the death had left her heartbroken and described him as a friend, a mentor, a guy so singular and dynamic you'd have to design a hurricane to contain him. Sir Anthony Hopkins said he was one of the best and a really nice guy as well, who had such a great spirit. Every day being with him was a high five. Soon after the success of The Silence of the Lambs, Demme followed up with something completely different, 1993's Philadelphia, starring Tom Hanks as a gay man dying of AIDS. Demme was also a noted documentary maker, with a particular focus on the musician Neil Young, as well as a career directing television too. If your film library is in need of an update, MUBI has your answer. The curated movie site of cult, classic, and award-winning films is waiting to be sampled right now. Head over to mubi.com/monocle for a free month of movies. That's MUBI/monocle. This is The Cinema Show on Monocle 24. I'm Ben Rylan. Just three films into her career, director Catel Quillavier has established a reputation for beautiful, delicate storytelling. Her latest film, Heal the Living, begins with a wonderfully shot sequence involving a teenage boy who, after leaving his girlfriend's house, heads out surfing, then ventures home, only to be tragically struck by a car. With no hope of recovery, his mother is left to decide what comes next, while another woman waits and wonders what will happen to her if she doesn't receive a heart transplant. With a musical score by Alexandre Desplat, Heal the Living is a delight both visually and acoustically. I asked Catel Quillavier how it all came together.
I think there's kind of three dimensions in that movie that I'm trying to keep together. It's the scientific medical adventure, the emotional experience, and also the metaphysical journey of that hurt, you know?
Do you like melodrama in other films?
Oh, yeah, I love melodrama. I'm really influenced by Douglas Sirk, you know? And other directors like James L. Brooks or Kenneth Lonergan, this kind of way of dealing with a strong story, a good story, and dealing with strong emotions.
What sort of process do you go through when you're thinking about how am I going to communicate this story? Because it's not about the details, is it?
when I have to deal with the character, I'm trying to be intimate with him, you know, to understand his own reason to behave and to act, to take a decision. And I'm always thinking about the feelings of the audience, you know, even if the audience is abstract concept, you know, because you never know who's going to watch your movie, who's going to like it or anything. But I think about these unknown people in a way, and I'm trying to anticipate what they are going to feel, at what time they are going to feel it, when they will need to breathe or to get into the action. And that's my way to deal with the story, I think.
Questions of mortality seem to be lingering quite often throughout the film. And it's interesting you reference religious texts and religious images. A lot of that is informed by people's anxieties about their own mortality. And much of religion seems to be this belief or this intent in having a belief that something will continue on even after our time here is finished. Does that speak to the plot?
Yes, because in a way, the organ donation could be seen as an experience of transcendence too, because you're leaving something from yourself in another body, in a way. It's also life after death, in a way, but on a real concrete way. But I think that's why organ donation has a real future also, because it can help people to deal with the loss, to know that something from the person you've lost is alive somewhere.
It's a beautiful musical score by a very, very accomplished composer as well. Desplat, he's such a wonderful, well-known composer. He's got such a distinctive style.
Well, I always dreamed to work with him because for me he's kind of a genius. But I didn't really believe it myself. You know, I just tried to get in touch with him because I have the instinct that maybe because he became so well-known, you know, and because he's so busy and working all the time with United States, with Hollywood, maybe French film directors were thinking that he was not accessible anymore. And in a way, people don't think about him anymore. And it's sad. And especially young people, they think they cannot have access to him. So I was telling myself, maybe he can be interested working with someone young, you know. And I think I had luck, because when I sent my script to him, he was in Paris for a few days. And he was going on a train, and he had a little time, you know, to read the scripts, because his wife wrote the script and liked it. And he really loved the story, and also the casting. And then we met, and I think that the meeting was really nice. Maybe what he liked also is that I proposed him something different.
Kartel Quilavia's new film, Heal the Living, is out now. And that's all for this week's show. Next week, we will take a look at the exciting new thriller, Lady Macbeth, with director William Oldroyd and star Florence Pugh.
What was interesting for us is that actually it felt like an undiscovered classic. And we felt that people coming to see it would be compelled by the central character of Catherine.
Today's show was edited by George McDonough and researched by Yolene Goffin. Don't forget to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your audio. The Cinema Show, of course, it's back next week. I'm Ben Ryland. Thank you for listening.